You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is with his wife, Louise, and if you want to send your best wishes for a speedy recovery for Louise, you can go to tomhartman.com, go to the message board, and they will be reading your comments, your prayers, your thoughts as you post them there. Again, I am Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. You can also find me on Facebook and other places. We've got a lot of great stuff to talk about today. There's been a giant breakthrough as far as LGBT equality goes. The EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they have come out with a ruling that basically says that if you are transgender and you are discriminated against based on your gender, that you can complain to the EEOC and see if you can't get that made right. This is huge news. Chris Geidner, he is the reporter that brings it to us. He is from Metro Weekly, the senior political writer there at Metro Weekly, which is a publication here in D.C. He's won awards for his work, and he joins us now. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carl.
So, first of all, congratulations on your GLAAD Media Award.
Thank you.
So, I read with great interest your piece titled Transgender Breakthrough, which people can find at metroweekly.com. So how did this come to be? I mean, it seems like only a few short years ago we were discussing whether or not the Employment Non-Discrimination Act should include transgender people, and now it looks like they may have leapfrogged the L's and the G's and the B's in their community in terms of workplace protections.
Yeah, I mean, the decision that was issued today was in the case of Mia Macy, who had been in the process of applying for a job with the ATF. And when they found out she had originally applied as a man, and was in the course of the background process, announced that she was transitioning and would be coming to work as Mia. And within a week of that, she was told that the position was cut due to budget, and soon thereafter found out that somebody else had been hired in her stead. Hmm. And what the EEOC did when it looked at it was looked at what is the very strong trend among courts who have considered this issue, that when you make when an employer discriminates against a transgender person because they're transgender, either in employment or as a job applicant, they are discriminating against them on the basis of sex, and that is
right.
Prescribed by Title VII.
And that's not always how it's been, right? I mean, you talk about some of the precedent that leads us to where we are today.
How originally people
tried to use this in the 70s, and the courts basically said, look, Congress had no expectation that trans people would be trying to use this for this purpose, so no, you can't use it. But over
right.
time, the 80s, the 90s, and so on, this has softened somewhat.
In the 70s, when some of the original cases seeking protection for trans people were coming forward, the way that Shannon Minter, the from National Center for Lesbian Rights, described it was disdain. That the courts really, they just weren't having it for the reasons that you described. But there were two Supreme Court cases, Price Waterhouse and On Call, and in Price Waterhouse, the Supreme Court clarified that sex stereotyping, that gender not meeting gender norms, was
gender nonconforming. If you're a man, not being masculine. If you're a woman, not being feminine.
Right. In that case, it was a woman, Ann Hopkins, who was up for partnership,
and she was told, I've got it here. She was told basically, you know, if you want to be a partner at Price Waterhouse, that's great, and you could be one day. if you style your hair, if you wear more makeup, if you wear jewelry, if you look more feminine, talk more feminine, walk more feminine.
Yeah, I mean, reading through the cases is really remarkable. I mean, they basically say that there was a type of woman who would be partner, and there was a type of a man who would be partner.
Right.
And Ann Hopkins was acting too much like the type of a man who would be partner to be a woman partner. And the court said, even though there were women who were partners, and even though there were men who were partners, this stereotyping on the basis of gender norms was a violation of Title VII, and that helped lead to this case. And the other case on call was a case where involving same-sex sexual harassment, and some of the courts had been split on that, but in an opinion by Justice Scalia, he, on behalf of a unanimous court, said that the plain text of the statute is what matters here, and just because it is going outside of the original intention of what the law would cover doesn't mean that it's not going to cover it when it's clearly covered by the plain text of the statute.
And let me just try and encapsulate why this is so important. I mean, most friends of the LGBT community, they think about marriage equality. They think maybe they thought about don't ask, don't tell. But you don't hear often about certain aspects of LGBT life, that in most states you can be fired simply for being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, simply for that, not because of your work abilities. Nearly 30 states, you can be denied housing because you're LGBT. Gay men cannot give blood, and so on and so on. There are just so many different things that are not marriage. So when you look at this is really quite groundbreaking. I just want to read a little bit from your piece, where you quote Mason Davis, who's the head of the Transgender Law Center, and he says that it's a big leap forward, because now transgender people who feel that they've been discriminated based on their gender representation can go to these equal employment offices and file complaints. And then the EEOC will follow up on those complaints and perhaps press charges based on it, in the same way that they do if you're a woman who feels that you've been denied, if you're a born woman who feel that you've been denied work because of your gender, or a man for that point. And 78%, you write that 78% of trans people indicate that they've faced this type of discrimination.
Exactly. I mean, this is a very significant ruling for all of those reasons. And then in addition, the ruling has two other elements that are really important. The first is that all agencies and departments of the federal government are bound by this ruling.
Right.
The EEOC's interpretation as to non-discrimination laws, the Title VII, the ADA, the ADEA, are binding on other agencies. So that means that throughout the federal government, this is now the rule. Secondly, EEOC interpretations are given significant deference in courts. So even outside of EEOC cases, courts that are dealing with these claims are going to give significant weight to this decision.
Well, and it's interesting because we've just left a moment, and I want to talk about this after this break, if you can stick around.
Yeah.
But we've just had this moment in the White House where they've indicated the president won't be signing an executive order to protect LGBT people from discrimination from government contractors. So I'm interested to see how that plays into this. It is 15 after. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, more with Metro Weekly's Chris Geidner. Welcome Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. I am Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about this breaking story out of the White House that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is basically saying that if you are transgender and you are discriminated based on your gender representation, your gender identity, that you can bring a claim against those. You can certainly file a complaint against those who have wronged you. We're chatting with the senior political writer for Metro Weekly here in Washington, D.C., Chris Geidner. You can find him on Twitter at Chris Geidner, G-E-I-D-N-E-R. You can also follow Metro Weekly at Metro Weekly. Chris, thanks for sticking around.
No problem, Carl.
So one of the things that occurred to me when I was reading your really great piece that kind of walks people through this entire story is that, you know, it was just a week or two ago that the White House indicated the president would not be signing any executive orders to basically put the Employment Non-Discrimination Act into effect as it relates to government contractors in the form of a, you know, executive order. How do you think this impacts that decision?
Yeah, well, I think that part of the story here is that there are several different tracks for addressing workplace discrimination in this
right.
country. And that's why I've avoided talking about the executive order as being a piece of ENDA or some of
because it would only apply to government contractors
employees. The issue that it would only apply to government contractors, but there's also additional things that it does that ENDA wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
The executive order would relate to the policy for federal contractor non-discrimination that's been in place since 1965. It's Executive Order 11246, and Lyndon Johnson signed it, and it prohibits contractors who get more than $10,000 in government contract a year from discriminating on the basis of sex, race, religion, national origin.
Right.
And this request is, and advocates are seeking it to apply to sexual orientation and gender identity. And the reason, and what that opens up is that there's an office, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, that monitors federal contractors who are doing this is able to address not discrimination that in which they may be engaging. And so that's something that even if ENDA was passed into law tomorrow, there would still be a push to have this executive order issued.
Okay.
And then a third portion is the EEOC. And what we've got with this decision yesterday is that as to gender identity, its inclusion, which would be specific to gender identity through ENDA, is currently included in the EEOC's operations through its position as a part of sex discrimination.
Right. And does the EEOC, if I were a trans man and I felt that I had been denied a job or a promotion based on my gender identity by a private company who has no business with the government, would I still be able to take a claim to the EEOC?
Well, you would be able to take a claim to the EEOC for a private company that does no business with the government.
Right, okay.
So this is
very sweeping.
Title VII is what ENDA is modeled after.
Understood, okay. So this is quite big news. I imagine that it's being heralded by the trans community and the broader LGBT community.
It is. The Human Rights Campaign put out a statement today about it. Mara Kiesling, the head of the National Center for Transgender Equality, talked about the groundbreaking position that this does.
And Chris, as is the case with all this stuff, how long, and I'm sure maybe it's already started happening, that the right wing in this country starts talking about bathrooms?
I'm sure that we'll hear it from somewhere, but as any state that's actually gone through a process of adding gender identity protections to its employment law, that is a red herring.
It's certainly a red herring, but they use it because they think it works. I would imagine, I mean, this story basically broke last night, right?
Right.
So I would imagine that in the days to come, the right wing, the folks that make their living and their organizations raise their money on the backs of LGBT people, will be running with this all over the country to raise money.
I mean, I'll...
You'll report on it if it happens.
I will wait to see what they do.
Right. Well, speaking of LGBT employment, the Romney campaign has hired an out gay spokesman to handle its foreign affairs, national security issues.
Yeah.
They've hired Richard Grenell, and he has been out for quite a while. He was a Bush administration official working in the foreign policy realm as well.
Yeah,
and a lot of people
at the United Nations.
Right, at the UN. A lot of people are heralding this as a big move, even though he's now scrubbing his Twitter feed from some insensitive remarks that he's made. What kind of indication do you think this, we've got about a minute left, what do you think this means to the Romney-Obama campaign?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, I would defer to Jimmy LaSalvia's comment that he made to me. He's the executive director of the very conservative gay group Go Proud.
Right.
And he said, I think Romney picked the best person for the job, and I think that's all you should read into this.
Well, Chris Geiner, thank you very much for joining me. I will say that I don't consider Go Proud a gay group. I think it's tough to be a gay group when you're run by a straight woman and you don't stand up for any gay rights. But Chris Geiner, always the diplomat, thank you very much for joining me. Chris Geiner, the senior political reporter for Metro Weekly. Find him at Chris Geiner on Twitter and read his work at MetroWeekly.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and when we come back, we'll be chatting about the Great Apes with Elizabeth Kucinich. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, let's protect the great apes. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. Carl Frisch here with you all afternoon. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter. Find me on Facebook. Is Congress capable of linking science, ethics, and fiscal responsibility to pass legislation? That is the question being asked by Elizabeth Kucinich. You know her. She's the wife of Congressman Dennis Kucinich. And also, she is with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Elizabeth Kucinich, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So there's this piece of legislation, the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act, that has about 160 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. Why don't you tell us what it is?
Absolutely. Well, the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act, we added the cost savings bit particularly for this Congress because we know what people are really thinking about at the moment.
When it saves money,
it
you have to tell them.
It would save $30 million of taxpayer dollars every single year. So absolutely, it's legit on that one. But really, the Great Ape Protection Act would do three things. It would phase out the use of chimpanzees in invasive research. It would codify a breeding moratorium that is already self-imposed by NIH, and it would release chimpanzees to sanctuary. And although this sounds like it's really a very common-sense reform, seeing as we are the last industrialized nation in the world to continue using chimpanzees, we're having a few little sticking points on the Hill, even though we've got a lot of support up here. So,
what are the sticking points?
Well, there was an Institutes of Medicine report that came out in December that said, you know what, we don't need chimpanzees for any medical research that's currently underway. And that was a fantastic report. So that really
right.
broke the back of the science. But we've got a lot of groups now who have these government contracts that actually warehouse the chimpanzees in laboratories. So we have a very, very small percentage of chimpanzees
it's
actually
kind of like the,
research.
It's kind of like the private prison industry lobbying against changing marijuana laws.
It's
not
exactly
because they don't,
that.
Not because they don't believe that pot should be legal, but because they want to keep the pot addict, you know, the people that get arrested for having pot in jail.
Money for it. And it's that kind of thing that we're seeing a little bit on the Hill with people who are sort of trying to counter lobby what I'm doing. But we're moving forward. There was a hearing today in the Senate, which went very well. And so we're hopeful that things will move forward in a positive way. But really need people to see that, you know, obviously I'm an animal lover, but also I work with physicians, and we're really interested in human health and those of people who are interested actually in getting therapeutics to market.
Well, technology at this point, I mean, technology has gotten to a point where you don't necessarily need this type of testing anymore.
No, there's amazing advanced technologies that are available. And so triple bottom line win on this, if you can get those advanced technologies into the laboratories and get these animals out, we're likely to get a lot more bang for our buck with a lot less suffering as well.
So what you mentioned that it's the more invasive types of testing. If we go ahead and get rid of using chimpanzees for those, what does that leave in terms of testing on chimpanzees? Is there less invasive things that they're used for that?
Well, we would just like this population to be released into sanctuary, and then they wouldn't be used for anything. Maybe they would be used for observational research where you don't have to interfere with them. But you know, science, as you say, has moved on. There are all these alternatives, and these beings are our closest, you know, genetic brothers and sisters, and we're still keeping them in cages that can be as small as 5x7x7 is the USDA
right.
limit, you know, cage size for a chimpanzee.
They're
very complex beings.
I think I've pinpointed the trouble you're having on the hill, and I want you to brace yourself for it, because I'm going to tell you.
Go for it.
Okay, here it is. You've said the word science. You've indicated that there might have been things called studies done. Those are code words to Republicans for science, and science is, to them, liberal bias, just like shapes and numbers and letters and math and the alphabet. So perhaps if you couched it in terms of freedom and liberty for the chimpanzees, they'd be more likely to run with it.
I'll try that in my next
Are any of the 160 co-sponsors Republican?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's actually a pretty good bipartisan bill, to be honest. In the House, the lead sponsor is Congressman Bartlett, and he's a Republican from Maryland, and
Is it Roscoe? Is that his first name?
Yeah, Roscoe. He was a former primate researcher.
Not so Roscoe P. Coltrane from the Dukes of Hazzard, but...
No, not that one.
Yeah.
No, but this is a train that's moving, and I'd love any listeners who are interested in this to really see that, you know, try and get involved with.
Well,
this.
Let's be clear. It's called the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. Where can people find more information about it online?
Well, our website is PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.org, and you'll see information up there, and we're sending out action alerts all the time. I'm very, very active on the Hill trying to get this legislation passed. It's something that I very much believe in, both from a compassionate standpoint, but also, like I say, from a human health one, and it just makes sense. So let's move ahead, and I'd love for people to visit PCRM.org and join me in this effort, because I really think we can do it this year.
How long would it take to, you know, roll all these different testing programs back?
Well, there are so few of them underway. There's only about four facilities that are actually doing invasive research on chimpanzees. This legislation would help save about 1,000 chimpanzees, but these are the ones that are actually being warehoused. There's only about 10% of the chimpanzee population that we have that are actually involved in active research protocols. So it's not like we're disrupting science terribly in order to make these reforms. It's that, you know, this is really the end of the road for this kind of research, and we need to move forward, and we just need to legislate to make sure that it actually happens in a timely manner, so that this money, $30 million a year, is significant, $300 million over 10 years. That's $1 for every one of us who lives in the United States. It would be great to have that money go to something that really worked.
Right. Or you know, if I'm sure Republicans would rather just turn it around as a tax cut for somebody. But at the very end, I mean, this is, for me, what it always comes down to is the science of it. And, you know, typically that's problematic because it doesn't play a heartstring. Science never does. But at a certain point, you get to a point where talking about the science of something should be, you know, there should be no debate. It should just be accepted as fact. And if you've got groups like the NIH and others coming out and saying, look, we don't need this anymore. You know, one of the things you write in your column that's in Roll Call today, people can find it at rollcall.com, is the IOM committee could not recommend continued use of chimpanzees in the research areas of hepatitis C, HIV, AIDS, K, cancer, Alzheimer's, malaria, biodefense, or any other current medical research. What that tells me is that the medical community is comfortable not doing this anymore because they don't need to. And if they don't need to, this is, you know, it comes similar to cuts to the defense budget when they're coming out and saying, look, we don't need this plane. And members of Congress are saying, all right, you don't need this plane. I hear what you're saying. We're going to give you 300 of them. How's that? So I can't imagine, you know, I wish there were 400 co-sponsors, because if the medical community, if the science community is coming forward and saying, we don't need to do this anymore. Look, we are able to do this with new technology. Why 400 members wouldn't say, okay, well then let's stop doing it. It makes no sense to me. What's the resistance?
Well, we're making it an issue so that those 400 members really get to hear about it, so that they can sponsor it. So anybody who's listening, if you go to our website, tcrm.org, and your member of Congress isn't a co-sponsor of this legislation, it would be wonderful if they could hear from you, because, you know, we're really trying to get this. Should be just a very easy thing to put away, but obviously there's a lot of things that are on people's minds, and it would be good just to show them that this is something that constituents are aware of and would like to see moved. And I know that there's a lot of big sticking points on some really enormous issues. So on these kinds of pieces of legislation, it should be
really
nice
easy to see,
to get it through.
It'd be nice to see Congress get something done this year.
I know.
Speaking of Congress, I would be remiss if I did not ask you if you have moving plans. Will you and your husband be moving to Washington anytime soon?
I have no. I'm in Washington D.C. right now. That's
Washington State.
I am.
So more specifically and broadly, the Seattle suburbs.
I'm sure he will let you know as and when he makes the decision. So if I knew anything, I'd let you know. But this man is so quiet. It's really interesting.
Well, I'm sure he's got a lot to consider. You know. I assume he's a co-sponsor of this legislation.
He is, and he was a co-sponsor before I started working on it. So, he's always at the front.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth Kucinich, for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Again, folks, if you're out there, you can go to their website, PCRM.org. It's the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And find out if your member of Congress is supporting the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. And if you feel so moved, take some action and get out there, because this might be an opportunity to actually get something done. Thanks a lot, Elizabeth Kucinich.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch. And we've got a great show coming up. We're going to be talking about ALEC, you know, that shadowy corporate interest that is putting this legislation in all over the country, including the Stand Your Ground law. And we'll be talking to Ari Melber. It's going to be pretty exciting. But up next, we'll be taking your calls. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Stick around. There's a lot more coming today.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, Carl Frisch here. We've got a great show all afternoon for you. We're taking your calls. Mark in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. How are you?
Yes, sir. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
All right, I wanted to address the other talk show host, not your last one, the one that preceded that one, in regards to homosexuality.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people are going to claim that I'm a homophobia, or homophobic, rather, and I'm not. I don't have anything against these people other than the fact that as a heterosexual, we have seemed to be losing all our rights as a heterosexual.
What,
especially if you're
sir?
A homosexual and
hey,
an
Mark,
employer.
Mark,
yep.
what rights have you lost?
Well, we're losing. I didn't say we lost.
Name one.
I said we're losing.
Okay, what? Name one right that you're losing.
We're losing our right to hire whoever we want to hire in any corporation or.
You don't have that right right now, sir. You can't not hire a person of color just because you don't like black people, for example.
First of all, it has nothing to do with color. Just so for the sake of the record, I am probably what you refer to as a black person. My skin is of a darker complexion.
Right, but if you didn't want to hire, if you didn't,
Mark, I was born that way. I was not. I did not come into this here.
Okay, so let me ask. I understand your point. I understand your point, Mark. You're saying that you were born African American, and that's not something you can change. I understand that.
I was born a person of color.
All right, I understand that. So let me ask you this question: when did you decide that you didn't want to sleep with men?
What made me decide that I didn't want to sleep with men?
Yeah.
It never was in my gender or in my in my way of being.
So you're saying that you were born heterosexual?
I was born to adapt to people whom I was accustomed to knowing that is what I'm attracted to. And that, I mean, you got me.
You learned by example? You learned by example from your heterosexual parents?
You can try to make me look stupid all you want.
I don't have to try.
Okay. Well, thank you anyway. But what I'm trying to say to you, and which you're not trying to comprehend, is the fact that I choose to be with a woman.
You choose.
Okay? And,
but you could go with a guy if you wanted to.
No, I don't know.
They're equal choices for you.
That is not the norm of our society.
No, I'm not asking about the norm. I'm not asking about the norm.
This is a male and female world. Now, if they decided...
I'm still a man, man.
If you want to go ahead and talk, I'll let you say what you have to say, and I'll be quiet, sir.
But you're not answering my questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to be quiet, and if I answer your question, would you allow me to make
my
course. Statement?
As long as you answer the question.
Well, what is your question?
All right, here's my question. You say that you choose to be with a woman, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So that implies that you have two things to choose from. So my question is... I assume you choose to be with a woman because you find certain women sexually attractive, but you also have, a love, an amorous love for them. You think about women, you want to have relationships with women, etc. I assume that's why you choose women. So my question is, if it's a choice for you to choose women, what are you choosing? Aren't you just choosing what is natural to you? Because you've already indicated that you don't want to sleep with men. You don't want relationships with men. And nobody's trying to make you do that. So what exactly are you choosing? You're just doing what's natural. It's not a choice.
It's not what I'm doing. And it is a choice. And I don't know where are you going with this.
My point is that you're saying you choose women.
Let me make my statement.
All right.
Quiet, and I'll listen to you.
Go ahead.
Can I get the same
Go.
Effect?
Speak.
The bottom line is that I choose to be with women because I am attracted to women. I am not saying anything that is wrong with a man who decided he wanted to sleep with another man. I'm saying to you that I don't have to accept it in the way that if you're going to come into my business and I'm thinking I'm hiring a man and you come back and say, well, I'm a transvestite or whatever, and I didn't hire a transvestite, I hired what I thought was a heterosexual. As a person, as an employer, I should have a right to hire what it is I want to hire. Now, if you have sexual preferences that does
Mark,
not meet my criteria,
Mark,
then you need to go to somewhere else that does.
Mark,
yes,
the point is that you should be hiring and firing people based on their ability. So here's a question for you. Here's the question.
What is my business?
Mark,
what is my business?
Mark, calm down.
Can I say this
calm
right
down.
Here?
No, let me finish.
Okay,
I just let you talk. Here's my point. If a person who is light-skinned and African-American came into your office, and you hired them because they were white, but then down the road you found out that they were actually African-American and you fired them, that'd be just as wrong as somebody coming in and eventually getting comfortable enough to let you know that they are transgender. At the end of the day, I can't help the bigotry that's in your heart. That's something that you have to deal with maybe psychological help, maybe a counselor, maybe a person of faith that can walk you through this. But I can't help you when you say that you should be able to fire people simply because they're gay, they're bi, they're trans. That's something that is a choice for you. The bigotry is a choice. The sexuality, the gender identity is not a choice, Mark. So, go to GLAAD, go to PFLAG, get some help because, until you make a choice to get better, nobody can help you. All right. Cliff in Santa Clarita. That's where my parents live, Cliff. How are you?
Yeah, interesting. Well, good afternoon.
We've got a minute, so you got to go really quick.
Okay, I'm calling about the nuclear power situation that's ongoing.
Yes.
So we got We got Fukushima teetering on the brink of an even greater disaster with this reactor 4 possibly crashing to the ground, creating a danger for the entire world, okay?
Right, they're saying it could be like 85 times worse than Chernobyl.
Well, I've been saying all along this thing is eventually going to surpass Chernobyl as the worst nuclear disaster, but we already have contaminated...
Cliff, ask your question as quickly as you can, because we're going to have to go to a hard break in just a second.
I want to know why there's not more outrage over the new nuclear plants that they are building in Georgia. That's my question.
Because Georgia is ruled by... you want my answer?
Yeah.
Georgia is ruled by corporatists, and all that matters is money. All that matters is money there. And that's unfortunate, but that's the world we're living in. And it's not going to change until we elect new people. So stick around. It's been a great show thus far. We've got two more great hours to go. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch all afternoon.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in this afternoon for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H.com. You can also visit me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. You know, Alec has been eating up lots of airtime lately as we learn more about it. And as more and more corporations feel the pressure to leave, we're seeing giants like Coca-Cola leave Alec. For those not familiar, Alec is that right-wing hub of state legislators that pass these bills that favor corporate interests, and in some cases veer into the non-corporate interest world, the non-tax issues, things like the Stand Your Ground law. So joining me now to talk about this is Ari Melber. He's from The Nation, and he's got a great piece about it in Politico today. Ari, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
You'll probably recognize Ari's voice from MSNBC, for those wondering out there.
Carl, that assumes people are listening and not just looking.
That's right. So tell me, how many companies now have left Alec?
Over a dozen companies have left in the last 3 weeks, which we can count as directly related to the corporate pressure campaign. And what I argued in my column today is that the most important or pivotal takeaway from this, in my opinion, is the success of dealing directly with the corporations as members of this group.
So my question is, you know, I remember a couple of years ago when companies like Apple and Nike left the Chamber of Commerce because the chamber just wouldn't accept global warming science, climate change science. The chamber's still around. It's still pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into elections against people that stand up for working families. What impact is this likely to have on Alec?
Well, in Alec's case, it has a huge impact on their brand and a smaller impact on their budget. I mean, these groups have given anywhere from $25,000 to $100,000. Their annual budget is around $7 million. You lose 10 groups at $100,000, you just took a 15% budget. You have to start cutting back or firing people.
So which is probably why they've gotten rid of this program, because it makes good politics, this program of non, you know, corporate interest stuff, because it makes for good politics, and it probably saves them some cash.
Right. So I think there is a tangible, measurable impact there. And I'm not suggesting that everyone is going to agree with every stance that corporations take.
Sure.
All I'm suggesting is that Coca-Cola doesn't have a corporate interest in denying people the ability to vote, which is what a lot of the voter ID laws have been about, or in changing the legal thresholds for determining when you can kill another person. You know, this is serious stuff. And to the extent that that was being funded in Coke's name, and they're a publicly traded corporation, they have public stakeholders, and they have the customers to worry about beyond shareholders. So to the extent that was happening, there's been a correction here.
Well, don't you think, though, that the reason is probably more likely the Trayvon Martin case and the Stand Your Ground bill than the voter ID laws? Because, frankly, you want to know what the stake of Coca-Cola is in the voter ID laws, it's less Democrats in office so that they can pursue these much more pro-corporatist agendas.
That may be. That may be, although I am not convinced that a management of many Fortune 500 companies necessarily want to go that far down the road. That is to say, they may have a business interest in the party that they perceive to be more business-oriented, and they may spend money that way. But when you get into the darker arts of politics, again, some listeners may say, oh, corporations are all doing terrible things. I'm not convinced that they're all signed off on every aspect of the Republican agenda, in the same way that they may prefer Mitch McConnell to be in charge, but they may not have a stance on the filibuster. When you ask average Americans whether everything should be put to a supermajority vote, even conservatives say, no, that sounds silly. So there's, as you know, as the listeners know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in politics that once you shine a little light on it and you combine it with a personal story, in this case, the tragic killing of the young Mr. Martin, then suddenly people have a different view.
Well, and just to give people an example of corporations not being entirely evil, we still don't have an Employment Non-Discrimination Act in this country, yet many Fortune 500, Fortune 200 companies have employment non-discrimination policies in their own workplace where LGBT people can't be fired, and they get great benefits packages that include their spouses, whether or not they're, recognized marriages by the federal government. So corporations do have that in terms of the ability to pursue their agenda.
And, another issue that's going to be hot this year because it's going to the Supreme Court, a lot of corporations have come out in favor of affirmative action policies and talked about how pivotal that is for the kind of country they want and for meeting the diverse needs of a diverse customer base and having a lot of people in the boardroom.
And immigration reform, which hits the Supreme Court tomorrow.
Right. So, look, I obviously am affiliated with certain liberal positions and I'm happy to represent them, but I definitely think that if you want to have a long-term strategy here, and this is what I say in the piece, as corporations are playing this larger role, we can't just work on painting them with one brush. I think people have to be targeted about working when we can with them, and there's obviously big synergies, to use a corporate word, when things are being done in their name that they don't even want to take the heat for.
Well, now tell me, so the Wall Street Journal, I found this very funny, started attacking folks, and ALEC attacking these companies and Coca-Cola and others who have left ALEC because of the controversy.
Absolutely. So the Wall Street Journal is probably the most influential voice for sort of business free market politics. That's what they're about. And they said, I'll read you the line. They said that the campaign against ALEC is basically similar to shareholder proxies that stop companies from giving to political campaigns. And I've got the other line here. Let me pull it up because I want to be exact. That they thought it was wrong of the Coke executives, quote, to be happy to get ALEC's help when it was in their self-interest, but heading for the tall grass when ALEC needs a friend, end quote. And look, corporations are like countries. They don't have friends. If you believe in the free market, then you believe that corporations will do what is in their interest only. And so it's very funny to see groups and the journal affiliated with free market politics talking about that as a goal and then being mad when the free market decides.
Well, and
want to support this.
If you wanted any indication that this campaign targeting the specific corporations that are involved in ALEC is having an impact, to see the Wall Street Journal editorialize against the campaign should indicate to anybody watching at home that this campaign is having an impact.
Absolutely.
So what's next in terms of the ALEC issue? I mean, this is something that really folks on the left have only really been mindful for about a year. Since I can't remember, it may have been Mother Jones or somebody else that had a great piece kind of detailing what they were. Is there anything on the left that even rivals or comes close to this?
There's a Progressive States Network. There are other groups that try to work at the state level. I don't know that all of the issues line up the same way. I think some of this has been playing defense.
Well, and for people that don't know, ALEC basically writes legislation, variety of issues, and then gives it to this vast network of thousands of state legislators to basically offer up under their own names and pass through their legislatures, right?
Right, and I think ALEC has been criticized especially for the lack of transparency and the confusion about that role. All groups can affect government and try to get organized. They have a hybrid model that's been effective, but also also confusing and also potentially misleading, because they have a lot of state legislators directly on their committees who then go and take ALEC bills and introduce them directly.
Sometimes they don't even take off the ALEC contact information and letterhead from the top of the page. I do want to talk a little bit about their legal standing, because there's been some complaints filed with the IRS. You mind sticking around for the next segment?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. We're talking to Ari Melber from The Nation about ALEC and what's involved and the stakes there. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All hail the corporation.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We've been talking about ALEC with Ari Melber from The Nation, who's got a great piece up at Politico.com. About how ALEC is alienating, its political agenda is alienating some of the very people that have kept it afloat all these years. Ari, one of the other things that, and thanks for sticking around, one of the other things that has been happening of late is people filing complaints with the IRS, basically because ALEC is a 501c3 organization, it's a charity. They're not allowed to lobby, but the argument goes that because all they do really is write legislation for legislators to pass, that that's a form of lobbying. What's going on there?
Yeah, there's groups like Common Cause that have filed these IRS complaints that are now being investigated, and the New York Times had a big expose on Sunday, including hundreds of pages of documents. The Nation magazine, where I write for as well, had several big pieces on this over the past few months. And if you Google The Nation ALEC, you can find a lot of that enterprising reporting, which frankly was some of the first national reporting on this score. The IRS is going to have to make that determination. That's a question that may be fine-grained and people may disagree with. The policy question is whether Congress should step in and tighten this stuff so it's not even a close call. That is to say, if you have, for example, a group with a lot of legislators on the group, you know, on the group's committees, granted the legislators pay in, it's not the other way around, but you could set a standard that that is going to be defined as not 501c3, not tax-deductible contribution stuff, and you could move forward that way.
One of the things that's always occurred to me when I've thought about ALEC is that the reason that they're so successful is not just because they've got the money to write this legislation and everything. It's because so many state legislatures across this country, the ones that are controlled by Republicans, frankly, are volunteer part-time legislatures where people don't get paid much money, they don't have staffs, they only serve, you know, in the state capitol for a few months out of every year. And therefore, anybody who makes their job easier is like the knight in shining armor. So here you have legislators all over the country that have passed, or introduced thousands of pieces of ALEC legislation because it's so much more difficult when you're only there for a few months, you don't have your own dedicated staff, and you're not paid enough to dedicate the time to write legislation for yourself.
I think you really hit the point there, and this is something that's counterintuitive because it's become so popular for people on the left and the right to beat up on politicians. Congress is very unpopular, as you guys know. But when the government's organized in ways that reduce the staff or the, you know, sort of long-term prospects of certain incumbents, that does create a power vacuum. And one of the ways that vacuum is filled is, as you say, by groups with the money and the organization to step in there. And conservatives have obviously dominated in many state capitals. So I think it's a tough one. On the one hand, you know, there's a good argument for term limit. There's a good argument even for part-time legislatures. But this is one of the drawbacks. And so, as I said, to be a broken record, because sometimes the solutions are simple, one thing that would be clear would be for state legislators and Congress to better regulate the groups that step into that vacuum.
Well, and, you know, I have a friend who's in the state legislature in Vermont, and they've got basically one legislative staffer per, like, three or four legislators.
Right.
And that's a liberal state legislature. So, you know, in the smaller states, it's a real problem. And in the bigger states, you know, you tend to have much more effective and prodigious legislators who handle constituent issues at the same time that they're writing legislation and getting lobbied, of course, by these very same people. So, Ari Melber from The Nation, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thanks, Carl.
Have a good one.
You too.
All right. Let's talk to Joe in North Platte, Nebraska. Joe, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Carl. How you doing, man?
I'm good.
What I'm trying to understand why is that you guys hanged up on somebody just because you disagree with him. All that gentleman was trying to tell you, Carl, was that he didn't like your idea of a person coming to his place of business as one thing and come out of cars and say he's another thing. I think that's totally wrong, and I think a lot of heterosexuality think it's totally wrong. I mean, just like if you had a business, and I know the guy that was talking to you, by the way,
uh-huh.
And if you had a business, and I'm the one that gave him an idea, that if you had a business, and a lot of kids, let's say you're a child, you was in a child-carrying business,
uh-huh.
And you were thinking that you had heterosexuals in your business, to raise these kids, and then
why would you not want gay people?
This guy
Joe, I've let you talk almost uninterrupted for a minute, so let me ask you a question. Why wouldn't you want gay people around children?
Because you don't want them to grow up like them. I mean, would you want your son?
I had a sheriff as a father and a mother who was a waitress. They're both heterosexual, and I turned out gay. People don't become gay because of the people around them. Heck, if that was true, then all the kids that go to Catholic school would come out as nuns and priests.
Well, some of them are. You know, you're in Chicago.
That's not true, Joe.
That was molesting those kids, and a guy came. And
do you realize there's Joe? Listen to me for a second. I want to be very clear with you. There is a difference. There is a difference between pedophilia and homosexuality.
Well, you're a homo, aren't you, Carl?
I'm a homo, Joe. Joe, what is this, third grade? You're going to call me a homo on national radio? Seriously, Joe? Joe, I think you need to stop smelling those diesel fumes and get your act together. Go find some love and peace in your heart, man. Maybe you should go see a minister or go see a psychiatrist. I think you've got some issues with your own sexuality. All right. See, that's what happens when we have conversations about LGBT people. You end up encountering these people, and you wonder why people would lie about their sexuality when they go in for a job interview. It's because they don't want to respond to bigots like Joe or like Mark, who called in earlier. That's why. And they shouldn't be fired for it. Let us be hired and fired based on our own merits at the job. That's all we're asking for. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking to Mother Jones, David Korn. Stick around.
Act like you haven't seen a Mormon before.
Jaws
down on the floor. I'm not concerned about the grape. We got it wrong. Sorry, that's not what I meant. I want
every American to be in the top 1%.
I'm really named Willard. That's my first name.
I'm not looking for a colony on the moon, just for someone to blame.
I like being able to fire people.
I'm Newt Gingrich.
You're fired.
I'm Rick Santorum, and I'm fired.
Boom, boom, boom.
Conservative women.
Love Mitt Romney.
And I love cars. I love lakes.
I'm running for office, for Pete's sake.
With regards to abortion, pro-life, pro-choice.
I firmly believe in my own singing voice.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Will the real Mitt Romney please stand up? I think that's what we're all waiting for. Joining me now to talk about Mitt Romney's latest and his new book, Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. We have one of my favorites, David Korn. He's the bureau chief for Mother Jones. Welcome to the show, David.
Good to be with you today.
So we'll get to Mitt Romney in a second. I want to talk about your book first. I just told folks, and they can find it on Amazon. It's Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. So give us the scoop. What's the inside story?
Well, it is the inside story. the book starts at the November 2010 elections, after the Democrats had this disastrous defeat and the House was taken over by Tea Party-driven Republicans. And it's an inside the White House account, behind-the-scenes account, how Obama and his senior aides
dealt with that through the lame duck session, which included, you know, which was successful and included getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, repealing the START Treaty, and, of course, this big tax cut compromise deal that at the time a lot of liberals hated. But I make the argument in the book that this was actually a way for Obama to achieve a second stimulus by stealth that the Democrats on the Hill themselves could not pass on their own. And then it, you know, goes through the 2011 year when Obama really sort of goes to political war with the Tea Party.
Well, and I kind of describe that time period as the Speaker has no clothes. I mean, he was Speaker Boehner at that point that year was making all kinds of agreements with the White House, and then, you know, hours later, days later, completely about facing on them because Cantor was undermining them.
Exactly, and the book goes through a lot of that with a lot of accounts of what's going on in the meetings with Obama and Boehner and amongst Obama's own aides, and also what's happening on the Hill with Democrats and on the Republican caucus. And throughout that stretch, while the president's trying to prevent a government shutdown and prevent a default with the debt ceiling crisis, he's also, you know, dealing with Egypt, Libya, and the bin Laden raid. And this is some of my favorite chapters of the book, because in those instances, the president is unfettered by the obligation of dealing with Boehner and the Republicans, and he can really sort of, you know, call the shots as he sees them. And, you know, I make the point that the book, in the book, that over the course of that year, the president had a strategic aim. To those of us who go on radio and cable TV day in, day out, and argue the cable fight of the nanosecond, we sometimes lose sight of that. And I include myself in that. And there are times when I'm thinking, you know, the president is, doesn't look like he's fighting. Doesn't look.
What
like
is he doing?
Like he's vacillating, or running away from things. For me, the great thing about doing this book was going back and looking at, you know, at events with a few weeks or a few months hindsight and perspective, and seeing how they all fit together. And I think, you know, overall, if you then, you know, continue down the course of the year through the jobs bill, and then he took a much confrontational approach, and he ended up besting the Republicans on the payroll tax cut fight. It was all designed, and it really was designed. I mean, I know this for a fact from talking to people in the White House and in Obama's most inner circle, that he
had. And it wasn't just one of those things where in the aftermath they look at the success and say, yeah, we totally meant to do that.
No, it really wasn't, because I was privy to some conversations, you know, in December 2010, when I was, you know, I was given privy to the president's thinking about what would happen the next year. And he really realized there wouldn't be a lot of legislating. There were these budget issues to get passed, but that he wanted to sort of spend the year setting up this strong contrast between himself and the Republicans, which by extension would work to whoever the nominee would be. We now know it's Romney, on terms of values and visions. And what the, you know, he used the Ryan budget as a stand-in for the Republican nominee, and Romney has done him the favor of embracing it, so, you know, there's no daylight between the two. And it really was, listen, these guys are going to have a dark, pessimistic view that all we can do is cut, cut, cut. My view is that we have to preserve the social safety net. We do have to do something about fiscal responsibility, but we also have to invest and innovate, educate, build, all these buzzwords that he's used over the past year. But I think it's not empty. He really means it. And the president believed that the Republicans would go too far.
Well, and I think any rational observer would say they have. Certainly, if you look at the gender gap, I mean, we're seeing gender gap numbers that mimic the 1980s.
Oh, yeah. But the thing is, other than just, it wasn't like a wish on his part. He had a plan to exploit that overreach. But he also felt at the same time, and this is why, you know, I found the book engaging to report on, and I hope it makes for good reading. Certainly, it's kind of dramatic. I have a lot of dramatic scenes in the book. But the president has cross-cutting demands. He has to be in charge of the government. He's responsible for the well-being of millions of Americans. He also has to be a political leader for a party under siege. And he also has to try to win a re-election.
Well, and I mean, one of my favorite moments that kind of epitomizes what it's like to be president today. We're coming up on Nerd Prom here in Washington, D.C. The White House Correspondents' Dinner is this coming weekend. And it was last year's, you know, Nerd Prom, the Correspondents' Dinner, that the president was giving his little roast and telling his jokes and whatnot in front of a room full of Washington insiders and B-list celebrities, all the while in the back of his head knowing that he was taking Osama bin Laden out that night.
Well, not well, actually the next day.
The next day,
the interesting thing was, because I go into this in great detail in my book, all the decision making that went in. He made that decision. The final order on that. The dinner was on Saturday.
Right.
Okay. He gave the final order Friday morning. The last meeting was on Thursday, and at that meeting, up to then, CIA analysts had told the president that they had a 60-80% certainty that the man in the compound was Osama bin Laden, but only 60-80%. The CIA then did what they call a red team exercise, which is kind of common for in the intelligence world. They take the intelligence that they've been looking at, they give it to a new set of analysts who have not looked at it yet, who don't have any vested interest in
right.
the conclusions. They say, tell us what you think. That Thursday meeting, the last meeting, they reported to the president, the CIA, that the red team had decided that there was a 40-60% certainty. So it's going in the wrong direction. At that meeting, Joe Biden and Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, his two most experienced national security advisors, both tell the president, let's not go ahead. Let's try to get more information on more intelligence before we make a final decision. So here he is. And no one in the room. He went around the room, his a small circle of advisors, and a few were in favor of the raid. Some wanted a missile strike, but it wasn't a majority. With
right.
the two most senior guys saying, "Don't do it." So on Friday morning, he gives the go ahead. It's like, if I have a shot at this, I'm going to take it. Is his attitude. Originally, the mission was to happen on Saturday, so it was quite conceivable that as he was joking and making fun of Donald Trump for all the birther stuff.
Right.
It was quite conceivable that it would have happened at that precise moment. The phones would have started going off at the Washington Hilton with the news. But because of bad weather on Saturday, McRaven postponed the go for another day. But I thought that, that chapter in my book, and just the whole story, reveals that the president has a tremendous amount of spine, and that he is indeed a risk taker. People think he's a weak negotiator. I think, at the end of the day.
Well, and it's not what one would conventionally think of as risk taking. It's more measured and thoughtful, and then being willing to jump out on a ledge if the instinct is there.
Well, he also knew, and it was discussed, sort of elliptically, that if you go back and look at Jimmy Carter's failed rescue attempt to get the hostages when they were held by Tehran in 1980, and you look at Black Hawk Down, that these type of missions can really go bad. And if
sure.
they do go bad, as in the case of Desert One with Jimmy Carter, it can ruin a presidency. If this mission failed, the president knew his presidency would probably end after the first term. So
sure.
he's taking this big risk. 79 Special Forces guys, he doesn't know them. Any one of them can make a simple mistake by accident and ruin the mission. And in fact, one of the two helicopters did crash.
Right.
And it was only because the president had insisted on coming in with a larger force that could fight its way in and fight its way out, that they had four helicopters rather than two. So his engagement at an operational level contributed to the ultimate success.
Of course, if you listen to Liz Cheney or Bolton, the only thing he had to do with the death of Osama bin Laden was that he happened to be in the White House at the same time. I got to tell you, your book, David, is a fascinating read. It's a really great insider's perspective, and I encourage we're running out of time here, David,
sure.
but I encourage everybody out there to pick up a copy at their local bookseller or on Amazon. It's David Korn's Showdown: The Inside Story of How Obama Fought Back Against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. David Korn, are we going to see you at Nerd Prom this year? And do you think the president will have any big announcements to make?
I'm not sure if big announcements. I always have some big jokes. I will be there. I go most years. I like the kitsch value. And if people want more information on the book, I encourage them to go to my Facebook page, which is David Korn DC. They can just search me on Facebook.
Great. And you can also follow him on Twitter, David Korn DC. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Carl.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. And when we come back, we will be chatting with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service.
Your You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, the latest political news with Ellen Ratner. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom this afternoon, I'm Carl Frisch. It is 10 till the bottom of the hour. Joining me now to talk about the latest breaking political news in our nation's capital and across the country is Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you. So the Senate Democrats wanted to support a NRLB, that's National Labor Relations Board, rule that would allow faster union elections. Well, of course, the Republicans don't want that too much. Why? Because, one, it gives the opposition, which is management,
right,
a lot more time to figure out ways to counter a union election.
Sure.
And the NRLB has ruled they want a faster election. Well, it went down in the Democrats' favor, 54 to 45 today. They could not muster the 51 votes to get that done. The Republicans are calling it reckless job killing.
I think unions know more about protecting jobs than the corporations that don't believe in workers' rights or safety. So call me crazy.
Not at all. The FBI director, Mueller, is in Yemen. And there is a town in Yemen, don't ask me to pronounce it or remember it, but basically it's run by Al-Qaeda. And so the Yemen force is apparently trying to get through to the town in whatever nasty ways they may be trying to do that. But the FBI director is over there talking about terrorism. Today there are going to be something like 39 amendments that are happening on the postal overhaul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has to do with the Republicans would like there to be $11 billion in a sort of incentive early retirement, leave now and, you know, forever hold your peace kind of thing, to get rid of something like 15% of the force. The Democrats don't want to do that. They would like to suspend Saturday, do some Saturday suspension of service in at least some areas, maybe close some post offices that aren't as useful, et cetera. But
it's sad because the post office was in the black until 2006 when Congress changed the law and basically said you have to fully fund the retirements for anybody who's currently working and anybody who could work for the post office over the next 70
years. Right, there's something like $8 billion just sitting there.
Right, and it's just sitting there. Meanwhile, they have to put in another $5 to $6 billion every year extra into that fund, which has made them go into the red. They've never been in
the red.
Well,
they were also for a long time prevented from really negotiating with people like FedEx, et cetera. Now, of course, you can have a FedEx box in a post office.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize that FedEx and UPS deliver a lot of their packages through the Postal Service, depending on how rural you happen to live. The other thing is that the post office has been kept from being able to raise its postal rates. And since the 1970s, the post office has survived on its postage stamps.
I mean, we, for goats for the old goat, we use the post office. It's
right.
It's the most efficient, inexpensive. You send a package through FedEx, I don't even want to talk to you about how much it costs. Okay, the president is on a two-day trip to various college campuses. Today he's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I believe he's going to be at the University of Colorado Boulder later today, and then Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Well, it's interesting he's back to the college campuses because I've heard that Mitt Romney had something to say about the young vote having to vote Republican this time around. Let's take clip one of Romney.
I think young voters in this country have to vote for me if they're really thinking about what's in the best interest of the country and what's in their personal best interest.
So that's Mitt Romney saying basically that young people need to vote for him because if they're thinking about the best interest of the country, then they should vote for him because of look how bad the president is, you know, taking this economy off a cliff. Do polls indicate that the young people are likely to be swayed to the Republican Party this time around?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say because the polls are very fluid at this
sure.
point. I mean, the president got at 50%. On the other hand, you know, it went down a little bit when Romney sort of came into being. Don't forget, today, I believe, is the four states, I think, including Pennsylvania.
Right, and Delaware. And
Delaware. And, of course, Newt Gingrich is saying, well, if he doesn't win Delaware, he may reassess his campaign.
Crazier things have happened. Remember, that's the state that Christine O'Donnell won the Republican nomination for Senate in a hotly contested primary, let alone what they've got going on there now.
Right. Senator Grassley said this is ridiculous because college graduates can't find jobs. Anyhow, Jay Carney went after Senator Grassley today at the Gaggle, which was taken on Air Force One, and basically said, well, he supported these economic policies that have gotten us into a deep
recession. And, you know, if young people are looking for jobs and Chuck Grassley wants them to find jobs, he could hire them to write his tweets, because his Twitter feed is absolutely unable. It's not even legible.
I've not even read his Twitter feed.
Oh, my goodness. He uses more abbreviations or fake words than anybody on Twitter. Even the 12-year-olds that follow The Wanted or any of the other new boy bands out there.
See, you're up in touch with popular culture. What do I know? The White House today condemned Sudan's incursion into South Sudan. Of course, as you know, I'm very active in South Sudan. Goats for the old goat. I always like to get that in there. And also the possibility, there's rumor has it, that another missile may be launched by North Korea.
Well, if the first was any indication of the second.
Okay, some other things happening. Mixed issue on housing. New home sale went way down last month. On the other hand, home prices were up slightly in February. So that's a little bit of good news, some not so good news. White House just issued a statement supporting the sexual assault policy of the military yesterday. The president talked about it today. He actually issued a statement. And today, Senator Schumer had a what I call get the popcorn out briefing. As you know, tomorrow is the hearing that is going to come up at the Supreme Court about Arizona's immigration law. So that's also going to be happening.
The papers, please. It was AB 1070.
That's right. So that is going to be happening tomorrow. And Schumer just tried to eviscerate this guy because I guess one part of the law talks about how somebody's dressed. Schumer said, how is it that an immigrant dresses?
Well, it's going to be interesting politics because now you've got Mitt Romney running away from the guy who kind of masterminded this whole approach to illegal immigration in this country, even though he basically said that the Arizona law, the Alabama law, those were models of what he would like to see throughout the rest of the country. I guess he's come to the realization that he can't win unless he does better with Hispanic and Latino Americans. So it's going to be interesting. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we come back in the next hour. We've got more great chat with some very interesting people. You won't want to miss it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It is 6 after. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. Good to be with you for this final hour of the show. Filling in, I'm Carl. You can find me at carlfrisch.com. Find me on Twitter, Facebook, etc. Let's take a call from Josh in Rock Springs, Wyoming. Hey, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Carl. Yeah, I wanted to respond favorably to you since the last two calls have been negative towards you. Now, about the gay hiring thing, you know, I don't get why these people are so uptight about it. I don't know if they are mentally ill or they're just influenced by someone, but, you know, I totally agree with you.
There was a study. I'll tell you this, Josh, and I'm not saying that they are, in fact, gay and repressed. I'll just tell you that there was a study that came out, I think it was a week ago, that said that people who are extremely homophobic might be hiding something that makes them feel defensive. I'll leave it at that. Let's take one more, and then we're going to go to a special guest who's with us to talk a little bit about ALEC and some of the great activism that's going on out there. Let's take Valerie in New York. Hey, Valerie.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
I'll be real quick. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to also say that the word he used, the H word, cut through me the same way the N word cuts through me. And, you know, a lot of people thought it was okay to pick and choose who could sit at their food counters. and made people use separate
right.
bathrooms. And I don't get it. They think it's okay to discriminate. When
well, and that was the point I was trying
themselves.
To drive home. He was basically saying that it's not a choice what race you are and that your sexuality is a choice. So I asked him point blank, when did he choose not to have sex with men?
Exactly. They don't get it. They don't get it. And,
it's lost
and
on
it's
him.
Very frightening because the young man committed suicide after outing
right.
himself from junior high school. And this is a very serious hate.
Meanwhile, you've got right-wing lunatics out there that say there's no such thing as anti-gay bullying. Don't victimize us by saying we can't preach our hate speech at young kids who might be gay. It's ridiculous, and it's sad. And it's why we need to stand up for groups like the Trevor Project and PFLAG, because those organizations really help gay kids, especially when there's people like those two callers that we had out there in this world. But let's get back to Alec, because I think this is an important issue that we need to delve a little bit deeper into, because it's not only Republicans that are part of Alec. There are Democrats as well. And joining me to talk about the efforts of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which you can find at boldprogressives.org, I'm joined by State Senator Eric Griego. He's a candidate for Congress in New Mexico, and he's one of the leaders behind this Dump Alec campaign. Senator, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me.
You know, I always find it funny when state senators run for Congress because they're basically running so they can be called representative, and then maybe one day they can get to be called senator again.
Well, I've been called much worse, that's for sure. So
I'm sure. I have today as well.
I want to make sure, Carl, I am not a member of ALEC. I just want to make sure that's
That's my point, right? I mean, there are Democrats in ALEC for some godforsaken reason.
Yeah, well, in our case, we have a kind of a coalition in the Senate of a few Democrats who vote with Republicans, and it is not uncommon on the floor of the Senate to have ALEC dinners announced and ALEC research announced and the extolling of the virtues of ALEC. I've never heard a similar speech, at least not from on any of our conservative leadership around the Progressive Change Campaign Committee or a Progressive States Network, the groups that are trying to, in a much more modest way, promote an alternative to this, this pretty well-organized and sort of insider's game that ALEC is promoting in legislatures across the country, and they're very effective. When it's one thing to have, I was reading the list of my colleagues on the website, on ALEC's website, who were part of it, but it's one thing to have most of my Republican colleagues on there, although even some of them are put off and are a little
sure.
afraid to even be on ALEC's website. But to see that we have some Democrats who are participating, whether they're official members or just going to the dinners and the schmoozing, I was very, very disappointed. Unfortunately, two of them have just, of my colleagues in the Senate, neither of whom I actually knew were members, have distanced themselves in the last few days from ALEC. And I think that's thanks to the work of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, of a lot of other folks who are really starting to hold Democrats accountable. And I think that's what this election is about, from the president on down to every state house across the country, is, if we're really going to have people who say, Democrats in particular, who say they fight for people, for working families, for health care for people, for investing in each other, as opposed to just taking care of the most well-heeled and most powerful corporations.
Why, Senator, why would you want to do any of that great stuff when you can weaken environmental controls so that you can give more children asthma and make money while doing it?
Well, as the father of a kid with asthma, not bad asthma, but it's so common. I'm
shocked. If you let ALEC have their way, we can make it really bad asthma.
Well, the beauty of it is that Big Pharma is also one of ALEC's big supporters, and they, I'm sure, are eager to develop.
Senator, that's what we call the circle of life when it comes to special interests. You pollute my air, I'll give you an inhaler.
Exactly, it's increasing market share. So let me just tell you, we have over 800 lobbyists in Santa Fe, in the state capitol, and the overwhelming majority are corporate lobbyists. So if that wasn't enough for the guys to be representing all of the big, and they're mostly the big corporate interests. Every pharmaceutical company has a lobbyist. Every big oil and gas company has a lobbyist. But in addition to that, we have these co-chairs in the House and the Senate of ALEC members who have a dinner annually, who fly people out to conferences,
But that's not lobbying, is it, Senator?
Oh, no, of course not, because it actually doesn't happen in the lobby. It happens at the swanky restaurant down the street called the Bullring. So,
but that's where the lobbying happens anyways. I mean, so my question is, one of the things that I was talking to Ari Melber from The Nation about Alec today, and it occurred to me as I've been thinking about Alec these last few months, and obviously more so since the Trayvon Martin case came to light. I have friends that, you know, that I've known for years through politics that in the last few years have decided to make a run for office themselves. And some have even gotten elected to state legislatures in places like Vermont and Maryland. And, you know, my friend in Vermont is a good example. She's a freshman state house member, in a volunteer legislature where I think she makes a couple hundred dollars a year. It's not full time. She doesn't have a full-time staff to help with her legislative duties, and they might even share a legislative staff between multiple members, and by staff I mean one or two people. Don't you think that that type of setup makes people more susceptible to groups like Alec and lobbyists?
Well, we're set up exactly the same way. We get no salary. We would get some per diem while we're in session. And
I'm not saying you should be lavished with money. I'm just saying that you should be at least put in a position that you can shut the door on those people if you want to.
No, but it's not just the money. It's the staff. I mean, we have a great legislative staff, but at the end of the day, often whenever I've sponsored lobbyists sort of regulatory legislation, what some of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle say, we need their help. We need their input. We need their help. And as opposed to it happening in restaurants, it really does happen in citizen legislatures like New Mexico. The lobbying happens from advocates outside the floor of the Senate. We're very accessible, but those are people who have to stand in line to argue for, you know, continuing Medicaid funding or to make sure we don't defund drug courts, as some of my colleagues have asked for. But the real work where you get 2 or 3 or 4 hours of a legislator's time happen at the swanky dinners, where Alec hosts folks and brings in these big national Republican speakers, and they fly you out to conferences.
Well, Senator, I want you to stick around because I want to talk a little bit more about this, because if you come to Washington as a congressman next fall, you won't be able to go to those swanky dinners. You'll have to stand up and eat the food, because that's real reform, and that's what we have in Washington. No more swanky dinners at restaurants. You have to stand at receptions. So
right, well,
this is the Tom Hartman program. Please stick around. We're talking about Alec, and we're doing so with a great state senator from the state of New Mexico.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up more on those Democrats that are part of Alec. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. Carl Frisch, it's 20 after the top of the hour. We're talking to Senator Eric Griego from New Mexico about Alec and all these Democrats that have been involved there and what Alec does and how we can kind of strike back and get the tide turning in the other direction. He also happens to be a candidate for Congress in New Mexico. Senator, thanks for sticking around.
Great to be here.
So tell me about your campaign. How is the Alec dynamic impacting what you're seeing on the campaign trail?
Well, I think people really want to have a choice. I have a contested primary, and I'm running against two much more centrist sort of corporate Democrats, and I have been able to really talk about the work that me and the other progressive members of the state Senate have done, and to really distinguish for people in primary. I mean, everybody thinks it's this Republican-Democratic dichotomy, and in fact it's not enough to have a D behind your name in a primary. People really need to know what you stood up for. So for me, it's been a good opportunity to talk about, you know, all of the legislation that I've been fighting for since I was, you know, I used to be city councilman, whether it was minimum wage, which of course all of the Alec local supporters in the chambers opposed, or whether it's asking out-of-state corporations to pay the same taxes as in-state. New Mexico is one of the few states left where you can actually declare your profits in another state, and that really hurts our revenues at the state level.
Sure.
And we've been talking about this for years, and at the end of the day, it's been some of my conservative Democratic colleagues who've been the deciding votes to us.
And that, you know, that ends up being a problem pretty often. I mean, even here in Washington, it's something you'll probably encounter if you make it to Congress. I mean, what ends up happening is you may have some liberal Republicans in Congress, But they always vote in lockstep with the Republicans. The problem with the more conservative Democrats, and I you know, frankly, there are districts where if a Democrat's going to represent it, it's going to be a conservative. But the problem with them, frankly, is that, you know, when push comes to shove, they go with the Republicans on a lot of these issues. They don't stand toe-to-toe with Democrats. So there really isn't this balance. We're much more diverse as a party and much less lockstep than the Republicans are. How liberal, conservative is your district?
You know, it's about a 55% Democratic district. So our current congressman was very much came out of the environmental community, very progressive guy, and now he's running for the U.S. Senate. And you
that's
know,
Martin Heinrich.
Heinrich, yeah. And so it's you know, this isn't Berkeley, or this isn't certainly
sure.
But you know, I don't think the things we're talking about are necessarily quote unquote progressive issues.
No,
they're Democratic and they're American issues. You know,
right.
Making corporations accountable and pay their fair share and not letting them get away with not paying taxes in New Mexico or
right.
The minimum wage or
Senator, they are people too, except when asked to do what people do.
Exactly. So that's my point is you know the great way to marginalize a lot of the issues that I've been working on as a state senator and hope to work on in Congress is to say, oh well, if you don't hold corporations accountable. And if you don't give them tax, for example, if you don't give them this tax cut or that tax incentive, the famous moniker in our legislature is you're anti-business, which means if you won't be an absolute lapdog for Alec and all those guys, you're anti-business. And what a lot of us Democrats are trying to say is, look, we're all for jobs. We just want to make sure we're not giving away the store and that we're also investing in schools and early childhood and healthcare, the things that build a strong economy, not just tax incentives. For the biggest corporations. And most of them are out of state. It'd be one
sure.
thing if there were a lot of New Mexico small businesses, and I'm sure my colleagues across the country face the same challenge. You
we
know?
Actually, you know, we have a call from Russ in Nampa, Idaho, who's got a comment about the Idaho state legislature. Maybe you have something to say about that. Russ, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Carl. Idaho's legislature is part-time also. They run from January until the end of March, sometimes a few weeks longer if they can't get their legislation suited up. But the legislation that you can expect from the Idaho legislature next year will be what's on the agenda for the larger Republican agendas from like Florida or from like Ohio or from like Virginia or Oklahoma, because they're not allowed any type of budget for staff or any pay. They get maybe about $1,500 for their participation.
Well, and,
in legislature.
You know, Russ, you end up with legislators then that can afford to serve because you really can't maintain a real job outside of that unless you have like a professional occupation where you can just take off 6 months at a time, right? What do you think about that, Senator?
Well, in our legislature, we only meet for once a year for 30 days in budget years, and then in the other years, we meet for 60 days. So it's even shorter. We get paid per diem while we're up there. But you're absolutely right. The folks who tend to be able to do this are either independently wealthy, have strong corporate ties, use it as a business development opportunity, or for a few of us, we have teachers. You know, I ran a nonprofit. You know, you have a few people who, you know, either have to work out a way that they don't go broke doing it or many of them just have to kind of make do. So you know, I commute to Santa Fe. It's an hour away. It's not a big deal. But, you know, for colleagues who are from 2 and 3 hours away, the per diem is never going to cover it. So they actually lose money being in the legislature. And there aren't a lot of people who can afford to do that.
Especially and get the experience so that they know what it's like to be a legislator, you know, after a few terms. I mean, I feel like whether – and you don't have to agree with me, but my opinion, term limits, these volunteer legislatures, these part-time legislatures – it's the wrong medicine for a real problem, which is entrenched incumbents who don't do the work of the people. But that's just my opinion. Senator, I want to thank you for joining me and talking with me about Alec.
Absolutely, and thanks a lot, Carl. And my website's griegoforcongress.com if you want to help. I really appreciate it.
And that's G-R-I-E-G-O, forcongress.com. Senator, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Carl.
So we've been talking about Alec. We've got a little bit more time left. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. In the next part of the show, the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking to Chris Mooney, who is the author of one of my favorite new books, The Republican Brain, Why They Deny Science and Reality. You won't want to miss it. It's going to be a great chat.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the Republican brain. That's not an oxymoron. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 34 after the hour. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook as well. You can find links at my website, carlfrisch.com. I want you to stop what you're doing right now and take out a pen if you're not at your computer and write down this website. You need to go to republicanbrain.com right now and order a copy of my next guest's new book. You won't be able to put it down. It's fascinating. And it's not satirical, okay? It's called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And the author is Chris Mooney, who joins me now. Thanks for coming on the show, Chris.
Hi, Carl. Good to be with you.
So I've seen you on television, and I've heard you on the radio talking about your new book. For folks that might remember, you also wrote the 2005 New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science, which sounds like a bookend to this. Is that what led you to write this?
Yeah. I found that after I wrote The Republican War on Science, things weren't getting better. They were getting worse. George W. Bush now looks like a moderate on science if you stack him up next to Rick Santorum. So what is up with this? And that's what the book tries to answer by literally going into the psychology of the right.
Well, I mean, the argument would be made, you know, at least when I talk to people about this, is it's pretty simple what's happening. The oil industry doesn't want certain things to happen, so Republicans don't believe it, you know, when it comes to climate change, for example.
I've found that that ends up being an inadequate explanation,
yeah.
Especially now, you know, even ExxonMobil, which really was, you know, the centerpiece of the oil industry's denial of global warming, it's not so extreme anymore, you know. It actually supports a carbon tax. But the Tea Party is more extreme than ever, and the denial of global warming is now a conspiracy theory claiming that scientists around the world have actually all collaborated to pull the wool over our eyes.
Right.
So it can't just be oil money. It's something else.
So what is the something else?
I mean, broadly speaking, what the book argues is that it's personality. And, you know, there's just a huge body of research showing that liberals and conservatives are just psychologically different people. And what matters about that is that liberals score really high on this trait called openness to experience, which is a lot like open-mindedness. It's much more than that. But it just makes them more psychologically similar to scientists because it means you tolerate nuance, ambiguity, uncertainty, change. You're comfortable with these things.
Sure.
Yeah.
And conversely, Republicans do what?
Well, they score a lower on openness, and that can lead to, I mean, you know, and it isn't absolute. You can have open conservatives, you can have closed liberals, but this is, you know, generally the tendencies of the groups. And that means, you know, it can mean a lot of things. At the extreme, it means authoritarianism, which is really, really, really
which
closed.
Is kind of like wanting to be led, wanting to follow what somebody is telling you to do, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. But what's really crucial there is also viewing the world in black and white terms and thinking that you're either with me or against me. And, you know, and wanting, you know, a strong leader who states things very strongly, very directly, with no ambiguity, with no uncertainty, with no nuance.
Making it very difficult for new information to make an impact.
Sure, sure. And another trait that's really interesting here that's, you know, that's sort of the opposite of openness is need for closure, need to have a fixed belief, need to have certainty so you can stop thinking about things.
Well, it seems that conspiracy theories would play well to that personality type. You know, the old adage of a conspiracy theory, if you present me with more information proving that the conspiracy is false, that's just more proof that the conspiracy is deeper than we ever thought it would be. And if you present me with more information that the conspiracy could potentially be true, that's just further proof that conspiracy is deeper than we ever thought it could be.
Well, and in global warming, it is now a conspiracy theory. And what's helpful about that is I'm not saying that every Republican's a conspiracy theorist.
No.
But what's helpful about that is that it shows that this is not about, like, people being dumb. Right, because if you're a conspiracy theorist, then actually you can spin out with your intellect all these elaborate ways in which everything you think is working, and you know more evidence and more. You read up, you know, you footnote everything. You have these, you know, you have post-it notes on your.
You at least have a response to everything that somebody on the left might say.
Yeah, and so you know, I mean, conservatives.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean the left. I meant on the science side might say.
Yeah, well,
Well, that's the other thing, is that, of course, the scientific community is liberal, because they're the same, you know, set of people in a lot of cases.
Liberal in personality, yeah. But, yeah. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean they couldn't be conservative in politics.
Oh, but actually...
It's probably less likely, but...
The members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science actually were 6% Republican in a recent survey. What I'm saying is that's kind of natural, because liberals and scientists think about the world in very similar ways, and basically, you know, they're all about exploring, finding out new things and new ways of doing things.
One thing I've always talked about, because, you know, I will make a confession, I experimented with being a Republican in my youth. One thing that I always told my new liberal friends when I switched sides is that they never understood why Ann Coulter and people like her were popular on the right, because of how, how mean they were. And it never made sense to them when I would say the reason that Ann Coulter is popular on the right is because she's like their comedian, and conservatives find it funny when they say something mean and caustic that's not politically correct, and it rankles the feathers of liberals. That's their sense of humor. How much of the obstinance when it comes to climate change science or other types of science or other factual information is simply because Democrats believe the other thing, the opposite?
Oh, gosh. I that actually, you know, a light bulb goes off, actually, in some ways. No, I think that is a lot. I think that there is conservative provocateurship, and they have a lot of fun with it. And I think that
it's foreign. I mean, if you talk to comedians, they'll tell you that, you know, liberal or conservative or not, comedy is funny even if you're being mean to people, as long as the audience knows that your heart's in the right place and that you actually are just poking fun, you know, in jest. But you watch conservative comics and they tend to say things, and you have no doubt in your head that the place that it's coming from is not a place of love. So they tend to fail in that regard, but they're no less popular with conservatives. Coulter's a good example. Jason Matera is a good example of saying outrageous things that get liberals angry, and then conservatives have a good joke and laugh about it.
There's research, because this is about personality, there's research suggesting that two groups have different senses of humor. There's a fascinating study on responses to Stephen Colbert, and both sides think he's funny. But liberals think he's funny because he's a parody of conservatives, and conservatives think he's funny because deep down he's really one of them.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I read that you wrote, you have in your book, and people, again, go to the republicanbrain.com and get your copy today. Find out more information. It's a really great read. It's, you know, I understand science is sometimes dry. This is not dry in the slightest. This is really great. You talk about how drinking can make liberals more conservative, at least temporarily.
Yeah, no, there's all this fascinating research that suggests that ideology is not about ideas, right? You know, it actually is partly physical. And so they actually set up outside of a bar with a breathalyzer and flagged down people leaving the bar and said they'd give them their blood alcohol content if they'd answer their political questionnaire. And so everybody shifted right in correlation with blood alcohol. And what's up with that? Well, you know, what blood alcohol does is it basically reduces your thinking to the more simple and quick. And, you know, when you think about a lot of conservative policy solutions or approaches to problems,
sure,
like, say, welfare, you know, their answer is simple and quick. It is, it's the fault of the poor person.
Make them work.
You know, work hard.
Right.
You know? And the liberals like, but there are all these institutional reasons why, you know, and they're starting. So, you know, it might be, this is not good news for liberals, right? It's actually,
sure,
good news for conservatives, because,
right,
if conservatism is the simpler default, then whenever people are busy or distracted or whatever, conservatives have a big advantage, and people are always busy and distracted.
Well, it certainly might explain some of the polling that shows that, you know, when asked, are you conservative, liberal, moderate, whatever, you know, that more people will say conservative than liberal, even if they don't know what it means. I mean, then you explain the positions on the issues that would make you conservative, and they say, oh, wait, no, I'm liberal.
There's another study in the same paper where they just give people words like civil rights and authority, and they say, how much do you like these words, how much do you agree with them? And the words are kind of political, right, civil rights and authority. And if you give people only a second and a half, they endorse the conservative words more. If you give them 4 seconds, they endorse the conservative words less. So it's like this speed thing.
If we give you time to think about it.
Right. Liberalism is like building on top of your instincts with something else.
And for the people that have been listening to the show all afternoon, this is further proof why we can't have part-time legislatures. We need to give them more time to think and deliberate, not less. Chris, what's been the response of your book thus far? Again, the go to republicanbrain.com and pick up your copy.
Well, like everything in America, it's this fascinating bifurcation and polarization. And I've actually heard from a number of the researchers now who I'm reporting on the science of ideology, right, of which there is a ton. And they're very happy. Like, you've represented my work very well. Conservatives, some of them, who are responding to it are clearly have not read it, but think that it's somehow saying they're dumb, which it isn't, saying they're abnormal, which it isn't. They have all these preconceptions, and they haven't bothered to sort of figure out that it's much more nuanced than that.
Right. I mean, your book is not saying that they're dumb or that they're crazy. I mean, that's something that I would say, but your book does not say that in the slightest. Chris, can you stick around for the next segment?
Absolutely.
We're talking to Chris Mooney. He's the New York Times bestselling author. He's got a new book out called The Republican Brain, Why They Deny Science and Reality, or The Science Behind Why They Deny Science and Reality. You can pick up your copy at republicanbrain.com. You can also follow Chris on Twitter, at @ChrisMooney_. You can also find him on Facebook and more information at republicanbrain.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back with more about the Republican Brain, which again is not an oxymoron, after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Believe it or not, there is a difference between the Republican and Democratic brain. More on that after this.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit CarlFrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. It's been a great day filling in for Tom while he and Louise are out there. And you can obviously keep up to date on how Louise is doing at TomHartman.com in the message board. And they'll be reading your messages. And thank you very much for your thoughts and prayers. It's been a great show. Before we get back to our great guest, Chris Mooney, I want to thank Sean, Jacob, Jim, and everybody else on Team Hartman for making this a delightful experience, as always. You can always follow me at carlfrisch.com to find out when I'm going to be filling in for Tom and others and what I'm up to in the media and my latest work. Chris Mooney, thanks for sticking around for us.
You bet.
So we've got a call from somebody. I want to see if you might be willing to see what they have to say. Let's take Tom in Seattle. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi. Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Chris?
Hi there.
Yeah, I loved your book, The Republican War on Science. You know, I think there was a visual pun there with the, you know, showing the back end of the elephant.
Oh, yeah.
But in 1974, my Chem 160 professor warned that if we don't do something about atmospheric emissions of CO2, that eventually we'll get to the point where shellfish will start to dissolve. It's happening.
Chris, what do you make of that? I mean, you know, one of the points you make in your book is that a lot of this denial of science and reality goes back decades, if not 100 years.
Right. Well, you know, concern about global warming, totally appropriate. We do not have any control over the problem. And the problem could be very, very bad. And the science of global warming, I just want to emphasize this on the air, science of global warming is 100 years old. It's as old as the science of evolution. What you're denying is, if you deny it, is a huge established body of knowledge in basic physics of the atmosphere.
Well, and the issue of evolution is not settled apparently in this country either.
Yeah.
You've got people still fighting that. Why don't we go ahead and take Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Program, Steve.
Yeah, I've got all the air monitoring reports since 1976. I've got about 25 different books, including Al Gore's. And I just haven't seen any credible evidence to support the rumor. And I say rumor because they haven't done the scientific method of gathering existing information to notify us of global warming theory.
Chris, is that an example of people who can probably talk about the issue in what seems to be an intelligent way, but they're not saying anything that's truthful?
Wow, I didn't hear anything truthful there. I mean, rumor, excuse me, I was just saying that in 1859, which is the same year that Darwin published The Origin of Species, a scientist named John Tyndall, Irish, experimented on the basic properties of carbon dioxide and found that, you know what, it's opaque to, you know, radiation, infrared radiation. And, you know, when you put that stuff in the atmosphere, he's figuring out how the greenhouse effect works. All right? It's physics. He's experimenting with the properties of carbon dioxide. This is its property. Well, right? You cannot get away from that.
Well, I mean, I love it because apparently some people think they can get away from basic science. You talk about in the beginning of your book, The Republican Brain, which people, again, can pick up at republicanbrain.com or find out more information, about how some people on the right are denying the theory of relativity.
Thankfully, that one's not too mainstream, but
yet.
I had some fun with that one at the beginning, because there is Andrew Schlafly, who writes Conservapedia, which at least claims to have a really large readership, and boy, they are wrong about so many things. So many things.
Well, I mean, at this point, you know, they've often said that, you know, conservatives believe that there is a liberal bias when it comes to the media. And, you know, after your book came out, The Republican War on Science, they might have said that conservatives believe there's a liberal bias when it comes to science. At this point, Chris, I'm beginning to think that conservatives believe there's a liberal bias when it comes to the media, science, shapes, numbers, letters, colors, basic things that shouldn't be debatable.
Reality, maybe. I mean,
yeah.
Stephen Colbert said that, to George W. Bush, by the way, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, so famous, he said, reality has a well-known liberal bias.
Right, and that was 6 years ago. That's yep. Happening again this weekend. By the way, that's the only time I've ever been invited to the Correspondents' Dinner was
awesome.
The Colbert one. And I have to tell you, the room was in hysterics.
Yes.
As I sat next to the seventh runner-up for American Idol from 3 years earlier, even he was laughing. And then, of course, reality was, you know, different the next day when the media was saying he went too far. So what do you think we can – I mean, obviously – this paints a very grim picture for being able to communicate to conservatives who are headstrong on these fronts. How do we get around that?
Well, that's really tough. You have to choose. Do you want to communicate with conservatives, or do you want to communicate with the middle? What we're talking
yeah.
about actually helps with both. I would advise communicating to the middle. But either way, what I think it shows is that, you know, liberals are we have our own assumptions, and we don't recognize how different we are from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So if you kind of read the research on, you know, the individual differences that lead to political differences, then you're like, wow, like, no wonder we're not getting through. And as soon as you start sampling that, you imagine, oh, hey, you know, someone just a little bit different from me, they're kind of probably going to respond to a lot of more conservative things too.
Well, I guess another way of thinking about it is that liberals are from Mars and Republicans are from Venus.
There is unfortunately too much truth to that.
Well, Chris Mooney, author of The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And again, go pick up a copy of the book. It's really fascinating. It'll give you a lot of insight as to why your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving says the things he does and just doesn't believe you when you present him with factual information. Visit the RepublicanBrain.com and get your copy. It's been a delight filling in for Tom today. Carl Frisch here with you all afternoon. Go to carlfrisch.com to keep up to date on what I'm up to and when I'm going to be back in this chair or other chairs on the radio dial or on TV. It's been a delight. Follow me on Twitter. Let's stay connected. Have a good one.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.